Good morning. So I posted a news on Fronter asking who would like to be in the reference group. And I have a big problem because all of you applied to be in this group. I'm kidding. I didn't get any emails. So I thought I would make it easy to say that either you wanted to be in the group or you could volunteer that I could be in the group if no one else volunteers. But I didn't hear anything from anyone. So, but this is just the NTNU way of making sure that the courses have quality. Is that there in each course there should be a reference group of at least three students that meet with me three times per semester. It will probably be two times now since we're a little bit into the semester already. And then you should just, so at the end of the course I need to write an evaluation about my perception of whether this course was successful, and the reference group writes a separate report of their perception of the course, what should be improved. And this is, I think, is the best way to do it, so you will have the power to give feedback directly into the system about what should be improved in the course from your viewpoint. So if some of you can just copy and paste either this or this and send me by email, that would be great. It's nothing scary and not any extra work really. It's just so we make sure that we document what is not working in this course so that I can improve that for next year or fix it for the rest of the semester. Things are getting a little bit more difficult now, right? Creating the Puppet module wasn't all easy, I suspect. And things won't be getting any more difficult, really. So, like, theory-wise, when you know the construction of a Puppet module, so the language of Puppet, how Puppet works, and the composition of a Puppet module, these things, that's sort of the more theoretical that's part or how difficult that will get. But now we will start encountering another kind of difficulty, meaning that we will start to implement infrastructures, meaning a group of computers that communicate, and things will not work and things will break and we have to figure out why. So now we will get to the practical, real practical difficulties starting today. Next week, next Thursday, there's an exam. There's no lecture on Thursday. I will lecture on Friday morning. I will record that lecture as well, but I will spend either 1 or 2 hours out of the first hours on Friday for the lecture, and then we'll do the midterm exam on Thursday. Don't have the rooms ready yet. I sent an email to the scheduling department asking for a room earlier this morning, so it will probably be one of the rooms around here. The format will be the same as last year's exam, which I published here. I'm quite sure that I will, if the format will be close to exactly the same, meaning it will be 12 questions, no aids allowed, you have 2 hours or 1 hour and 45 minutes, and on paper, some theory questions, some practical questions. I will ask you about the lab exercises. I will ask you about the readings. So remember that anything that's listed in Fronter without parentheses is mandatory reading. So this is some of these questions we haven't focused on this year. So like, I wouldn't use this question this year. But most of the other questions are relevant. So, but this will be the format, some theory questions, some more practical. I will ask you to write a puppet manifest. And I will ask you some theory questions about Puppet. I will ask you some questions about DNS, etc. And sample solutions for these are also, so this is last year's midterm exam. And sample solutions for these questions you will find here. And I also published the sample solutions for the last 2 weeks of the problems. Any questions about the midterm exam? You will get all paper you need to write on from me, so basically you just need to bring yourself and a pencil and you're fine. You won't need a calculator or anything. Okay, so the big thing was to write this Puppet module. And I've the actual files you needed to create are in the PDF document, but I also uploaded this this actual module with all the files that so includes the RSpec setup for testing, etc. So you can download and unzip this. And then, so this is a setup of a module, of course, where the key directory is this, manifests. There are some other important directories of a module as well. For instance, maybe you want to distribute some files, and then you would have, so when you run your module on some node, it will also download some files and install some files, or a template of some files, and then there might be directories here called files and templates, which you will see next week. But as I mentioned, what you had to do was basically create these four files. In a Puppet module, there should always be a main manifest called init.pp. There has to be a manifest called init.pp, which is the entry point to the module, and this init.pp file should have a class named the same as the module. So that's why you see also when you run Puppet module generate, it will generate an init.pp with an empty class named the same as the module. So I need to have a class called Goosin Backup here. And I need to specify this class with all the parameters that I can use to modify this class. And these parameters, they need to have default values. And all the default values we put in a separate file for this to be modular and easy to read. So that's why you see that all these values here just refer to Goosin Backup module, params file, or the params class, and then these variables. So let us So the params class, Goosin Backup params, notice name of the module, double colon, params. This class should then be in the manifests directory. So you don't have to say Goosin Backup, double colon, manifests, double colon, params. When you say the name of the module and then refer to a class, Puppet knows that it should look in the manifests directory. But if I were to put this class or this file in a subdirectory, then I would have to modify the name here so that it would match the name of that directory. So if I were to have for some reason I would have several parameters files, so I would to have this nice hierarchical system, I would create a directory called parameters, and I want my params file to be in this directory like this. Then I would have to do the following. Like this. Link between the file name and location and the name of the class. And you have to do it like this for Puppet to find these classes. Okay, so in the params, there are all the default values, and you should try to have a default values for all variables, if you can. So for this module, it doesn't make sense to have default values for what you should backup to which destination. We can't assume anything default about that. That is something we should require to be specified. So that should be that the source directory and the destination directory is undefined. They have to be specified. All the other options, I have proposed some default values. So when someone uses this module to install the script, if they want to have a different maximum file size, maybe I want to do backup of files that are bigger than 100 megabytes, then they can easily, when they declare this class, just override this parameter with a different value. But same defaults are important. So that's the params. And in the old days of Puppet, you used to use inheritance a lot. That you would create one base configuration, and then you would inherit this and modify it for other nodes. But in general, this inheritance, when you start to scale things up, this causes a lot of problems. So in general, in Puppet, you don't want to inherit only for these parameters. So these are the only times you use inherit for transferring default values of parameters. That's sort of the only recommended time in Puppet that you use inheritance is this case. Then, since the user should provide a source directory and a destination directory, I'm just demonstrating the use of an so-called intrinsic function, so a Puppet function. Puppet also has a bunch of functions that you can use. And you can define your own functions, of course, as well. So there are standard functions for checking that these parameters are actually defined in a syntax that is a valid file path or a directory path. So then I declare the class GoosinBackup install, and I use arrow chaining, which is just another way of saying that this class requires this to be completed first. So to make sure that I install before I configure, I just use this chaining syntax, the same as you saw in the examples for the NTP module. And then again, I tried this morning to figure out why I did this, but I wasn't able to figure it out. So I still don't know why I do this, so don't worry about that. What can be a little bit confusing is that, you see, class GoosinBackup. So here, GoosinBackup is outside the parentheses. Class GoosinBackup, while here class GoosinBackup inside brackets, braces, curly braces. Yeah. So it's important that you understand the difference. When you say class GoosinBackup, you are defining a class. You're creating a function, if you will. When you're declaring it like this, you're using it. So this is creating a class called GoosinBackup. This is actually executing or declaring or using this class, which is defined in the install.pp file. So when I do this, I'm actually executing the code in there. And this is basically all I want to do. In my top level class, I just accept parameters, and then I want to install, and I want to configure. So let's go to these two files and see how this is done. You see, it's really not that much code. And when you if you look at the most advanced Puppet modules and start looking at the code, you will see that, wow, there's really not that much code. And that's some of the point here, is that try to keep it simple. So divide it into files. Don't try to do too much. And small files with just a few resources like this is completely fine. So here I create the function, if you will, GoosinBackup install. So this is what will be executed from the top level class. I need one parameter, I need the install directory. Then you saw from the exercise that you... No, it wasn't in the exercise text. But if you read about the Goosin backup software, for it to work, you need rsync and you need Crudini. So these packages must be installed. And for installing from Git, you also need to make sure that you have the Git command if you don't have it yet. So if when you're going to install, first thing you have to do is to make sure you have these packages installed. And you see that this next resource here requires that the package Git must have been installed before I do this. Okay. So this is a resource declaration called VCS repo. Which Puppet resource is that? We view the Puppet resource type reference. Where we have, yep, here's the package we use, the file, exec, cron, etc. There's no VCS repo. Why is there no VCS repo here? Yes? Yes. So... Exactly. It's not a native type. It's not a direct type. So I just want to repeat this. You know, Puppet has these native resources. But for basically for most of the things you do, you use these native resources every now and then. But for most of the things you do, you extend by including other people's module. So because I have installed... Because I've installed the Puppet Labs VCS repo module, I have this resource available. And I can use this, just say VCS repo, to this directory, ensure it's present, use Git as the provider. This is the source URL. This is all I have to say, that this Git repo should be cloned into this directory. Then, after I've done this, I have to make sure that the actual script is executable. So I say that file, install directory, this goes in backup, should be executable 7.5.5. So this is just downloading and installing from Git. Here, and after this you need to configure, and configuring that's when you need to actually use all these parameters. I asked you to use the Puppet Labs ini file module. That's also described in the modules documentation, that one of the widely used modules, because sometimes you need to edit files. And the easiest way and the obvious way for us to think about this is that can't I just have a file in my module, a configuration file in my module, and just copy it into place and it has the content I want. That we can do that. But how do you know that this code is the only code that's using this file? So like if it's a configuration file for a web server, are you sure you want to statically copy one specific file? There might be other modules, other code that's also want to make changes to that file. So sometimes the best thing, if you need to make changes to a configuration file, is to just edit the parts that you need. And you can do that if the file follows the ini file syntax, meaning that you have sections defined like this. Maybe you have a section called agent with some variables equals a value. You know that you have sections with variables you set. This is one of the widely used formats, but there are several other formats as well. But Boosting Backup follows this ini file syntax, so we can use the ini file module. And when we need to define several, we need to change several of these, I could use the ini setting resource and just repeat it again and again and again. But if you read carefully the documentation for ini file module, you can edit multiple settings in a section at once, like this. You set that the default value is the path to the configuration file. And then you can define a hash with Linux as the section name here, and then these values which should be set. And then you can call the function create ini setting with settings and defaults like this. So if you need to edit many values, then this is maybe the most efficient way of doing it. If you just need to edit a couple of values, then you use the ini setting resource. But this is all described with the Puppet Labs ini file readme page. It has all the examples. So this is just an example directly from this example. Manage multiple ini settings. Yeah, you set the defaults like this, you set an example like this, and you do create ini settings. So I just copied and pasted this example and just expanded it. So this does the editing of the file. So we have already installed the software. Now we edited the configuration file. Then we just have to initiate it, complete the installation, or complete the configuration. And that is creating an entry in Kron, like this. And then, again, we can use a native resource type. Because Kron entries are a Puppet native resource, which we can use like this, to say that it should execute on the schedule that's defined in the parameters. Okay? Was that a difficult exercise? Yeah. It's fascinating and it's difficult because there's really not that much code, but you have to understand how it all fits together. So, but please let me know if there's anything you want me to repeat or that we've talked about at any time in the course. It's a really bad sign when you see that your browser tabs keeps growing. This is a measure of how stressed I am when I have to browse horizontally to find things. It's this annoying saying that when your head is below water, you don't notice that you're sinking. Sometimes it's a little bit that feeling. So I need to get some tasks out of the way so I get all my browser tabs back on one page. Then I'm in a good place. Okay, so we now have the last. Yep. Yep. Ask me by email. I really should use some kind of question forum here or something, but I haven't done that yet. I should have done that, but please send me email. Some of you do that, but I'm not that stressed out that I don't answer email. Email always has priority one, and you are priority one. And it's really good to have you guys, because then I have a reason for pushing administrative things away. So, because working with discourse is what I really want to do. So please send me email when you have questions. And what I do is that if I see that this is a question that most likely applies to more of you, then I publish a news about it. Yeah. That's why I noticed that someone had problems running Puppet because they weren't running as root. And then I remember, yes, of course, that's what everyone does when they start using Puppet. They forget that Puppet needs to be run as root. And that's why then I published a news about that. So please send me questions, sometimes I publish news about that. Yeah. Okay. The last thing we're going to do before the midterm is to introduce how we use Puppet in a real setup with a Puppet master and Puppet agent. Because writing Puppet code and applying it on one node, sometimes you want to do that as well. It's many times I've been thinking about that whenever you have to do a single installation of a computer, if you have to reinstall your computer, some of you have probably done that multiple times, and then you want to recreate your setup. Like I would like to have that on my phone. I had a very strange crash with my phone 2 weeks ago. Suddenly it was a brick. I touched something on the screen, and suddenly my phone was a brick. I tried to remove the battery, like 10 times, wait 20 seconds, anything, and no way it was booting back up. I had to do a factory restore. You know, hold down home button and volume up and these three buttons for a few seconds, and you get into factory restore and you can reset your phone and you lose all your settings. So I had to do that. And of course I had then had to restore everything from Google, and I recreated basically everything, but something got lost, something is manual, etc. The funny thing is that, and this is really strange, never happened to a phone before, and I've never seen it happen to anyone else's phone before, that it just out of nowhere it becomes a brick. And then the next day I was together with someone else, and I see that they're standing there removing the battery and stuff from their phone, and the same thing happened to the exact same model, Samsung Galaxy S5. To my phone and someone else's exact same model got bricked within 24 hours. It's really, really strange. Can't be a coincidence, I think. But I haven't found any information about it. And I'm not sure Samsung wants to necessarily share anything about it if there was some strange thing. Yep. So whenever you restore or reinstall something, couldn't I just have a Puppet manifest that I run and then restore everything? Yeah. And this is good when then you do Puppet apply, just on a single node. It's very nice. But most of the time, you want to create a Puppet configuration that you use to manage a couple of 100 servers. So a couple of 100 servers might sound a lot, but believe me, when you start managing computers, before you know it, you have 100 servers, you have 1,000. And then you want a methodology that scales. So we're going to set up an infrastructure, and we're going to look at how the Puppet configuration is assigned to nodes. So if you have 100 servers, then they should have different Puppet configuration. The web server should have a different configuration than the database server. And who is going to give this configuration to this server and this to this? And this is called Puppet needs an ENC. And the Puppet ENC is the function that does this. This is the So we need an external node classifier. And the one we're going to use as ENC is Foreman. If you end up using Puppet professionally, you will probably use Puppet Enterprise, which has a Puppet Enterprise graphical web interface, which does this also. And Foreman is just a slightly more general open source alternative. But it's pretty much like the Puppet Enterprise kind of interface. This is one of the few documents that I've created for this course, because this is our base scenario. So we're going to create an infrastructure, and we want an infrastructure that has the property that basically anything can fail and we can recreate it. So we should expect failure. Those of you who took Kyrre's course in the spring semester, you probably heard about the Chaos Monkey of Netflix, right? That Netflix, to make sure that their system always survives, they have a Chaos Monkey, which is basically software that breaks one of their servers randomly at any given time, but I think only during ordinary work hours. So it's a basic philosophy that if you want to be stable and you want to be protected, then make sure you attack yourself all the time. So you are prepared to survive an attack because you're always under attack. That's a good way of thinking. So we should be prepared that any part should fail, or any part might fail, and we should be able to, either we have redundancy, so it's not noticeable, but we should always be able to recreate it as quickly as possible. So we're going to start by creating three servers, and we really want to just treat one of them, maybe two, manually. So whether we have 10, 100, or 1,000 servers, we should only touch one of them. The rest should be completely self-configurable. This is the This is, of course, an old philosophy. In 1998, two system administrators, Steve Trogot and Joel Huddleston, they published this paper at USENIX LISA. And by the way, the LISA conference, that's the place to be. If you like system administration and you want to go somewhere and meet other like-minded individuals and hear about all the exciting stuff, go to LISA, Large Installation and System Administration. And USENIX is the best organization to be as well. So this was LISA, has been running for almost 30 years now. In 1998, they published this paper, Bootstrapping and Infrastructure. And they were already talking about virtual machines. So, the model we describe treats an infrastructure as a single large distributed virtual machine. And they describe this methodology that they use whenever they go to a company to install an IT system. They would first make sure that they have version control. Wow, 98, way before Git was invented. They were not even using SVN. They were back at CVS. So version control and the gold server. This is the manager. This is the only server that you want to touch manually. And when you have this in place, you need some other administration tools, some installation tools. You need your directory servers. This is DNS and possibly LDAP. You need authentication. You need time synchronization. Notice that one of the first things you have to have in place to have a stable infrastructure is DNS and time synchronization. And then you have the rest of the functions before you end up with client application management. And this is still good reading, but some of the technology mentioned, of course, is old. But in 98, Puppet was not invented. But you see, he mentioned CF Engine. So CF Engine was already popular in the 90s, and is still a good alternative to Puppet. So just... yeah. So, the test we used when designing infrastructure was, can I grab a random machine and throw it out of the 10th floor window without adversely impacting users for more than 10 minutes? So this is the thinking, you know? But here they were talking about physical machines. And the point is, we have to be able to recreate everything as soon as possible. So even though we are tempted to do things manually, we don't. We do not want to do things manually. We only do things manually on our manager. So we should have one host which controls everything. And of course, we have to think about that this will break as well. So make sure that we have all our data here somewhere else. In case our manager fails, we need to restore it as soon as possible. Yep. Okay, let's break for 15 minutes. Yes.
Yeah.
So you will get a heat template from me, where there are three servers: manager, monitor, and dir01, which is a directory server. And I have deliberately made this slightly difficult, or created something that is not as easy as it can be, meaning many times you would have an all Linux solution. That would be clearly the easiest. But we need to work with Windows computers and Linux computers. On the server side, you will encounter that you need to manage Windows computers and Linux computers. So let's do that. And managing Windows means that somewhere at the core of your infrastructure, you need Active Directory. That's everywhere. So let's have a Linux manager with Foreman. So Foreman will be our interface for viewing the status of everything. And then we need an Active Directory server, which we, for now, will just use as a DNS server. And the monitor, we should just initiate Puppet, so we see that we use this sort of initially for testing that it works against Foreman, but this should also something that we will not manually configure at all. So I tried to write down here these different roles so you know the functionality. So this should be our overview. The manager, that's Foreman, which is a web application. That will be our interface. And we can talk to Foreman either with the web interface, or we can use a command line interface, which is called Hammer. So Foreman is our controller and our interface, and either the web interface or the Hammer command line interface to Foreman. Foreman uses a proxy service for doing other things. Meaning Foreman is a complete solution for deploying and managing computers. So I want Foreman to tell Puppet which hosts should have which configuration. So Foreman should control Puppet. And Foreman should tell Windows to update DNS when I register new hosts. And these things, Foreman has a separate service called Foreman Proxy, which does. So Foreman Proxy manages Puppet, and Foreman Proxy manages DNS. So for now, we use the Windows server just for DNS. So this will receive dynamic DNS updates from the manager. And it's very important that you note that so this host should be able to write to this host. How can we do that securely? So we have to be careful. And the way we're going to do that is that we're going to create a user here that is allowed to update DNS, and then we export that user and password in an encrypted way in one file and store that here. So this host here will have a keytab file, which is basically a username and a password in an encrypted way that it can use to securely talk to Windows to update the DNS. And we also use this to run the Puppet agent on. So we see that we can configure Windows and we can configure Linux from this Puppet master. So this is our base infrastructure that we will roll out. And then later we can add any kind of servers and any number of servers within our quota in OpenStack to this infrastructure. When we start setting up this, you will see that you will get errors and things might not work. And I just wrote down some troubleshooting tips. There's a reason why I say that DNS is a core part. Almost, I guarantee you that at some point you will run into something not working, and it's because of DNS or some kind of host name resolution. It's fascinating how many times that a problem goes back to DNS. So if you need to troubleshoot something, try to draw an overview. So like if you try to update DNS on the Windows server and it doesn't work, you know that maybe you're running the Hammer interface and Hammer is talking to Apache because Foreman is an web application which runs under Apache. Foreman uses the smart proxy, its smart proxy service to talk over the network and then to the Windows DNS server. So now these are the components involved. And all these components, you have a chance to listen to what they're doing, ask them to be verbose. So first thing you should do, if you run a Hammer command and it doesn't work, so say minus V for verbose output, or minus D for debug. You can always ask a command to generate more output. Then you should see the log files. On a Linux server, log files are traditionally here. And you probably see that I many times use the command ls-ltr to see which file was changed most recently. So when you know where the log files are, remember that for any service, you can usually ask it to be more verbose in its logging. So in a configuration file of services, we can increase the log level, so we get more information in our logs. And usually the final thing, but sometimes also still useful, is to inspect traffic over network. If it's a client-server system, and you're supposed to see some kind of protocol traffic, use TCP dump, see if it's actually happening. Is it sending traffic across the network? Yeah. And of course, each service usually have a manual that, and many times has special information about how to troubleshoot, that says these things in more detail. Okay, let's... I like Wikipedia. Because Wikipedia, yes, it's quite easy to introduce errors here, but if you write something erroneous in Wikipedia, it's usually fixed quite soon by someone that will become annoyed that you have entered an error in Wikipedia. And for many of the key technologies, hundreds or thousands of people are contributing to documenting how they work. And to have a source of theory, practice, without being locked to a single vendor. That's what's nice about Wikipedia. So for practical system administration and knowing a little bit about the protocols involved, Wikipedia is an excellent source. You know, but always keep in mind that anyone can edit it. But that's not a reason for not using it. In many, many times, Wikipedia is the best source for information. So if you want to learn about DNS in a practical way, then read Wikipedia. So I've just linked to this here. I expect you to read this document and know basically how DNS works. Not all the details. I won't ask you about the history of this, but I expect that you know how a DNS lookup works, what are the DNS resource records, and how a reverse DNS lookup works. So read this, study this figure, So this is the core functionality. You know that there's a sequence of lookups. There's a difference between whether a DNS server is recursive or whether it's caching. Reverse lookup. And there should be an DNS resource records. Let's see. So the most common types of records stored in DNS is, you know, for IP addresses, the A record, and 4xA for IP version 6. Finding a mail server is the MX record. Delegating to another a domain, you use the NS record. For reverse lookups, you use the pointer record, the PTR record, and the CNAME record. So these are the most common records. You read this. Another thing we will do at the same time is that when we're moving our code into a master agent setup, we really need to separate code from data. So we need to configure some services that will have some IP addresses, that will have some passwords, that will have some usernames, and these things are specific to our implementation. And things that are specific to our implementation, that's data that we should not have hard-coded. And what we do in Puppet is that we use a separate, simple database called Hiera, because it's a hierarchy, where we put our data. So we're going to introduce Hiera as well, and this is a brief lecture introducing Hiera and how it works. I think Spencer Crum is the guy who invented it originally, and he is much better to describe Hiera than me. So we're going to learn these things, of course, continue what we're already doing, learning by example. What did I do now? I closed. Yes. And there is a document here for the Hiera official example from the Puppet documentation as well. Okay, let's get to the real stuff. And this week, there's no the problem document, just have some theory questions. So there's no big challenge. This week, just do what's in here. And remember that we should be able to just, at any time, basically we should be able to delete what we're doing and recreate it. So now we're going to start from scratch again. But note that this first stack, we're going to do manual configuration. So this should probably be something you launch. And if nothing happens, then you will keep this for the rest of the semester maybe. But be prepared that it might crash. I'm not going to do what like Kyrre does and crash stuff for you. Remember that things can happen. And right now this is still running on on hardware, which is in a quite dangerous environment. Meaning if power fails to one of our buildings here, everything will go down. So within a few weeks, the entire Sky-High cloud will be moved to a safe environment, but it's still running in a location where if someone kills the power, then everything will go down. This has happened a couple of times, and we have been able to bring everything up. So hopefully you won't lose anything. But be prepared that this is not completely reliable yet. So download this heat template and launch it. Let's view. So this is a heat template with three servers, and let's see, there's nothing special going on except here. So this launches Manager, Monitor, and Directory 01. And Directory 01 is the Windows server. And when the Windows server is initiated, this script runs. So you see that I provide this server with user data. When we launch the rest of our hosts, we're going to do this for the Ubuntu servers as well, in a slightly different way. But since Windows Server 2016 is not ready yet, is it? It's not out yet, is it? Windows Server 2016 should be released at the end of this month or something, people are saying. But let's see. Maybe it will arrive and we will be able to use it. But for now, we're stuck with 2012 R2. And 2012 R2 does not have Windows Management Framework 5.0. And Windows Management Framework 5.0 is the framework that has PowerShell desired state configuration. And PowerShell desired state configuration is basically Puppet implemented on Windows. It's amazingly similar. And we want to use that. So when we launch, this is the URL to the most recent Windows Management Framework 5.0, unless something has happened in the last few weeks. So the server will download this. You see, this is PowerShell code. I have this URL. I have a path that I want to create. So I do the temporary location and merge. Temporary and say, yep, the temporary directory in Windows. I should have a file called vmf50.msu. And then I download this URL to this path. And then I set the administrator password. And then we install the management framework, which will then trigger a reboot. This process here takes about 15 minutes. So when you launch your infrastructure, make sure you wait 15 to 20 minutes before you use the Windows host. You might be able to use it before, but if you see that you can log in without a password, then you know you're using it too early. Because then you haven't reached this line here where you set the Windows password yet. Remember to provide a password that is strong enough, that has uppercase and lowercase, or and a character and a number or something. If you just say password.1, that's good enough. But make sure you use a typical, like, slightly strong password so that you're not stopped by a weak password. password not working. Yeah, so you know that. Wait with using the Windows host. So create this. And then, so the first thing you should do is to start working on this Windows host. But I just told you that you have to wait for 15 to 20 minutes. So then you have to sit there like this. Please don't. Because before you set up Foreman, you have to have the user in Windows so you can set up so you do dynamic DNS updates. But please read and study the rest of the exercise. Prepare the other things you're going to do while you wait. So what you should do manually on the Windows host is we're going to use later in the course, we're going to learn a little bit about PowerShell desired state configuration. But for now, we're going to start using it. So you in PowerShell, you install module xActive Directory, which will give you some PowerShell desired state configuration resources that you can use for configuration. Then I have a script here that is a desired state configuration script, which will basically install Active Directory automatically. It will ask you for three passwords. Just use the same password for all three users or something you remember. Notice that in this script, you don't have to replace this IP address unless you have if you have changed the IP address in your heat stack. If you don't want, by default, this will be the network 192.168.180. And if you change this, then you have to change this in this script as well. This will also take a little bit of time and reboot. This will take a little bit of time. When you run this script, when this completes, you have turned the Windows server into an Active Directory server and you have the borg.trek domain. So when you then log in, you have to log in as Borg administrator, as the domain administrator. So when you have logged in again, then you create in Active Directory this user that's going to do the dynamic DNS updates. So we call this user Foreman proxy. And then you set some kind of password on this. This is just my proposed password. Change this to something else. But this is the command. Put this on one line. Whenever you see that I write the command and I indent it like this, it means it should be on one line. So this is for creating the user. And then we manually add the resource records, the forward A record and the reverse PTR record for manager. And notice that whenever I write something in uppercase, I expect you to change it. So, because I don't know what your IP address for manager is, because that will be assigned by DHCP. And the way things work in Sky-High is that all your hosts will be assigned an IP address automatically. But we want static IP addresses. But don't worry, when your host have been assigned an IP address in Sky-High, it will be static. It will keep the same IP address all the time, even though it's using DHCP. So that's why I'm saying that, but I don't know if your manager will be 180.101, 102, or 103. Probably one of these, or 104. So check your IP address of the manager. Insert that here. Same when you create the reverse lookup. Last octet of IP address of manager. Which octet, of course, is this here. This last entry. Because an IP address is four octets. Like this. So while you're waiting for Windows, you can start to install or do the first part of Foreman on Manager. Remember this locale fix that I mentioned at the beginning of the document. You should do this first. Then you need to install Puppet Server. So you make sure that you have version 4 of Puppet. Then for installing Foreman, you add package sources for Foreman, run these commands as is. Before you move on, first DNS trap. Make sure that, ensure that if you do the command ping and what it's returned from hostname minus F, that this shows the real IP address, not the local host IP address. Make sure this happens, because if this command gives this output, then the following installation will fail. So make sure you read everything and just ask me or your neighbor if I'm busy if you have a question. So on both Linux and Windows, if you just manually need to set up some kind of name resolution, you don't want to use the DNS system, I just have to manually, you have the hosts file. The good old host file from the early 80s and maybe 70s still exists on Linux and on Windows. You can make manual entries. Yeah. And that was the internet, you know, at the beginning of the 80s. You were actually sending around this host file, because there were only like a couple of tens of computers on the internet. Well, that was actually back in the 70s, but DNS was created to avoid distribution, manual distribution of this host file. But it still exists. Okay, so we want to use a domain called borg.trek. I was actually thinking about switching this to a Pokemon domain name, but let's stick with Star Trek. That's more in line with system administration. So, since we want to use our own local domain, we have to override the information that we get from OpenStack's DHCP server. And there are several ways of doing this, but I think the best way is to manually or edit the DH client file, which is the service that retrieves the DNS or retrieves DHCP information. So at the end of this file, dhclient.conf, we add these two lines. So you just execute this command to add to this file, but also here insert the IP of directory 01. Because you will probably have different IP addresses for your Windows server. So that IP address has to be inserted here. And again, I remember from last year, many people forgot this semicolon, and then things failed. Yeah. So make sure you do everything exactly as here. So IP address, semicolon should be there. Then you reboot to make sure name resolution is okay. Then you can install Kerberos, set this up, and all these things you can do while waiting for Windows. Because you see, down here, here I provide Kerberos information for Windows, and then here I ask to authenticate with Windows using the Foreman proxy user. So you cannot do this before you have completed the Windows installation. But you can do everything down to here. So here we create this file, which basically contains the username and password on Windows, so that we can talk to DNS. You get the file called foremanproxy.keytab that you put in this location. And then we're ready to actually install Foreman. So we update, so we get the sources for Foreman from the Foreman repositories and not from the Ubuntu repositories. Make sure you do everything in sequence as listed here. Because if you haven't done this, the commands above, you might be able to install Foreman, but then you will get an old version of Foreman, which will break because that doesn't work with Puppet version 4. So make sure you do everything in sequence here. Foreman is nice because the Foreman installer is based on Puppet. So it actually runs Puppet for installing Foreman. So just run this with all these options. As long in Linux, as long as we have the backslash, you can just copy and paste this. But notice, you should have to provide what is the DNS interface. Here you have to insert, it's probably called ENS3 or something. You will see that if you do... PA. Yeah. So you see, I have the loopback interface, and I have ENS3. By the way, does anyone know why it's suddenly called ENS3? We're used to it usually be calling ETH0 or ETH1. And then I've seen and suddenly I saw some servers, they were named EM1 and EM2, and then they were P0, P1, and now it's ENS3. Okay, so I've lost a bit overview. So there's some kind of interface name. It's probably ENS3. But this name, you have to insert here. Let me see the rest of here. IP of directory 01, you have to insert here. Then this will output, if it's successful, an admin username and a password that you have to make note of. When this is complete, then the Foreman proxy user exists and you can set the correct ownership of the Foreman proxy keytab file. So we created this earlier because we needed it, but this file needs to belong to the Foreman proxy user, which does not exist after we have installed Foreman. So, where are we heading with this? Then there's a bunch of things that you should do in Foreman. But these are easier. I think I've documented everything here that you need to do. But as you see, there's quite a lot of work, but it's just copying and pasting. But read everything carefully. Let's do the punchline. (Clears throat) So I set up dynamic port forwarding so that I can enable Foxy Proxy. And where, let's see. So this is Foreman. And it should probably end up with version 1.12.2. You log in with admin and the password which you hopefully wrote down when you installed Foreman. And then you can change it later. I hope I remember my... Site is at theforeman.org. Ah! 1.12.3 is out, actually. So that's the one you get. So Foreman is a complete lifecycle management tools for physical and virtual servers. And if you just, like, we also use it to install physical servers. So this is a complete system for provisioning, installing on hardware, or starting host in the cloud, wherever. You can start, it doesn't have to be OpenStack, it doesn't have to be Puppet that's doing configuration management. It's a very general, powerful tool that can provision from anywhere, can do configuration, it can monitor hosts. So this is also our cool interface that we can show our boss. You know, your boss doesn't want to see Puppet code. He wants to see, things are being managed. And there are green lights all over the place. You know, the machine that goes Bing. Yeah? No. It's just a web application. Yes. This is the management interface that will show what Puppet is doing. That Puppet successfully configured all your hosts. That's what we want to see. And so right now I'm managing 7 hosts. And they are all out of sync. Does not look good. Yes, because I'm doing some experiments here. So this is just the main overview, which of course I can configure anyway. If you remember from IT service management courses about ITIL, one of the key things for being professional service management is to have a CMDB, a configuration management database, which is basically inventory overview. That's one of the things Foreman does. So these are all my hosts, and for any hosts, so this is the Windows hosts, and I can view all the information about it. Physical processor count, this host has 2 processors. So Foreman gathers all information about all hosts. Whenever Puppet agent runs, it will write a report back to Foreman so I can see if something was changed or if it keeps being stable. And of course, I can create groups of hosts here. So, host names, you see. But I just told you, maybe we have 1,000 hosts. You don't want a list with 1,000 hosts. No, if you have 1,000 hosts, I would group them into host groups. So I would look into each group. You know, quite easy to make this scale. But the important thing is that I want to assign a Puppet configuration to a host. So, like this Windows host, I want to assign a specific Puppet configuration to it. And the way I can do that now is I can edit the host. Then I choose Puppet classes. And okay, now you see that I've already added the class profile base Windows. I can remove that. And if I do submit now, this host is now not managed by Puppet. And as you see, I have a whole bunch of Puppet modules here. And you know, we can see all these have all these different kind of Puppet classes that I can declare on this host. But this is where we get to the next step. That what we really want to do is that each host, I don't want to manually assign a bunch of classes here. I just want to give each host one specific role. That's what we're going to learn about after the midterm. But for now, we just create one special module called a profile. And this has two profiles, a base Linux configuration and a base Windows configuration. And the Windows host should have this configuration. And I just submit. And within half an hour, this Windows host will now apply this Puppet configuration and install some software, synchronize time, and do all the things I've defined in this base profile. So Puppet is the system that will assign a specific Puppet configuration to a specific set of servers. So that's the ENC functionality. So we use Foreman for ENC, and we use Foreman for monitoring, overview, for impressing our boss, these things. Then, so you should spend some time studying Foreman and this interface, and feel free to ask me. There are some things you have to do, like especially here, when you boot a new host. In your later templates, I've created them so that they will automatically join Puppet. What you have to do manually here is approve them. So if I want to see, are they approved as parts of the Puppet network? Because this is, of course, security. Then there are public keys that needs to be exchanged and so on. So you choose infrastructure, smart proxies. You see that I have a smart proxy and I use it for DNS update and for Puppet configuration, and for Puppet certification authority. So it says it's managing 7 hosts. And it will show that I have signed the certificates and approved the certificates of these 7 hosts. Yeah. So if I want to remove a host, then I have to revoke the certificate here. So Foreman is not very difficult. It's a web interface, but look around in the menus. If you want to change your password, you can do that there, of course. And ask me, of course. But this is we're now at the core. We need to learn Foreman. We know Puppet as the language. And then the only thing missing now is to introduce the workflow for doing this professionally, but that we will do after the midterm exam, when we evolve the process of moving Puppet code into Git-controlled repositories and automatically distributing them to the right environments. Foreman also allows us to place hosts in production environments or in testing environments, and I can set this up very nicely. Okay. See you tomorrow then.